So I think at the start, when you're talking about the word consciousness, what we mean by consciousness, or what I mean by consciousness, mm-hmm. more particularly, so that when I'm talking about consciousness, you know where I'm coming from. Because we use the word in so many different ways. It's easy to think when you're having a conversation with somebody that the way I'm using the word is the same way that the person you're talking to is using the word. And it's interesting, in Sanskrit, you've got maybe a dozen different words for consciousness, or slightly different aspects of consciousness. Here we just have consciousness and awareness. Some people differentiate them, other people think they're the same. And mind gets wrapped up in all that. You know, we talk about, you know, persons, you know, maybe their social consciousness or their environmental consciousness or their political consciousness. And we're talking about, what we're talking about there is their values, their way of thinking, how they interact with the world, what they hold as important, that sort of thing. So we're talking about their way of being in the world and what's important. We talk about those sorts of things. And we also talk about consciousness from a spiritual point of view and say, oh, this is a conscious person. Meaning that this person maybe is more conscious of certain aspects of reality or aspects of themselves. But we can easily get into judgment there that this isn't a very conscious person. And you know, that's something to be careful of. But that's one way we use it. And higher states of consciousness, meaning, again, that we may be aware of, conscious of different aspects of reality or different aspects of ourselves. We use it, I mean, the sense of being awake. You know, I'm conscious. People often like to say I'm sort of unconscious when I'm asleep. But actually, you know, you're still having dreams when you're asleep. Not, but if you're having dreams, you're aware of the dreams. So in that sense, there's consciousness during sleep. It's just, it's not consciousness of the external world. It's consciousness of an inner world. Or we talk about focus of attention, you know, the thing of, I'm sure you've all had, you know, when you're driving home and you know the road so well, you get home and you might say, oh, I wasn't conscious of where I was at all. I just got the, clearly you were conscious, but maybe your attention was somewhere else. Your attention was on some thought or whatever. And so some of your awareness was on the road and getting home and driving, clearly, otherwise you'd never have got there. You'd be in a ditch. What we mean is, where is the focus of my attention? So we use the word consciousness in that way. What I'm actually conscious of in the moment. So we use consciousness in that way. The way I use the word consciousness is really to do with what's general to all of those. And what's general to all of those is being aware. Being aware, having an experience. And that, to me, is what consciousness is. And for me, I use the word awareness synonymously. I don't find a need for me to differentiate them. So that's just the way I use the words. So we are all aware. And in fact, that's probably the one thing we cannot deny, is that we are aware. Whatever we're doing, whatever we're experiencing, we are aware. So being aware is an absolutely universal aspect of our life. There's never a moment we're not aware. Well, there's never an experience where we're not aware. I mean, whether we're aware or not in deep sleep or under an anaesthetic is a question which people debate. But you know, any experience you're having, you are aware. You cannot have an experience of not being aware. It doesn't make sense. So that's what I mean by consciousness, is that faculty of being aware, being awake inside, which is always there, always there. What changes is not consciousness in that sense, the being aware. That doesn't change. It's always the same. I mean, how it feels to be aware now is how it was for you yesterday, a year ago, when you were a kid. That being aware is always the same. What changes is what we're aware of. So sometimes I distinguish between the faculty of consciousness, the ability to be aware, and then what appears in consciousness, which is the forms that appear in consciousness. Although strictly they're not really forms, it's the activity which appears in consciousness. And all we ever know actually is an appearance in consciousness. Right now we're experiencing this room, you're hearing my voice and whatever else you're experiencing, your body. All of this experience is actually an arising in your own consciousness. I mean, we think we are experiencing the world directly, but we know we aren't. One thing that science is absolutely clear on is we do not experience the world directly. We think we do. We have this beautiful, very good virtual reality we create for ourselves, which works so well. We can interact with it, and you know, I see the wall over there, and I go over and touch it, and there's something solid there. It works. And so we forget that we're actually living in a virtual reality. And what's happening is information is coming in through the senses, through the eyes, through my ears, through my body, all different ways the information comes in. And the brain, I mean, does this absolutely amazing operation. Within a tenth of a second, it's taken all this information from all these different senses and integrated what it knows from the past and other things, and puts it all together, and a tenth of a second later, this experience arises in consciousness, this multidimensional, multifaceted, incredible 3D, touchy-feely, surround sound, full virtual reality, which we actually live in. But it's all just an appearance in consciousness. We never actually know the outside world directly. And in fact, we don't know what the world is, what physics is showing us. This is 99.999999% empty space. When you get down to it, there's nothing there. Really is nothing there. But there's information, and that information gets translated by us into this. I mean, there's no colour out there. I mean, talk about the furniture, you see red or orange. There's actually no orange out in the world. All that's happening is there's something out there which reflects light in a certain way, and that light that's reflected has a certain energy, which is just a certain frequency, which is just ways we talk about it. We don't actually know what it is, just ways we talk about it. And that energy stimulates certain receptors in the eye, which send certain chemical impulses down nerve cells, but they're not orange impulses. There's no orange there. In the brain, it's just electrical. The orangeness only arises in consciousness. And you know, the soundness of the voice, everything, the smell, all of that only actually arises in consciousness. And so that's one of the ways when people say, you know, consciousness is the foundation of everything. It's the absolute foundation of everything we actually know, actually experience. And that's one of the senses in which consciousness has infinite potential. It has the potential to become any possible experience that you could ever have. Any possible experience you could ever have, it has the potential to become that. Or that any creature could ever have. I mean, there's creatures which have senses which we don't have, like dolphins who see in sonar and bats. It has the potential to become whatever that's like for them. We don't know what it's like, but it has the potential to become that. Or electric sense, which fish have, has the potential to become that. Or whatever intelligences are living throughout the universe, whatever senses they have, whatever they're aware of, it has the potential to become that as well. So in that sense, it really does have infinite potential to take on any particular manifestation. That, to me, just continually boggles my mind. All we really know about the world up there is there's information. And more science is coming to theory of information about the world and working with the information. You know, so an electron, say, we've no idea what an electron is. We talk about it as a particle. We know it's not a particle. We know it's not really a wave. All of that is just the human mind taking experiences from this reality and projecting it onto an electron. All we know is there's a bit of information we call mass. We don't really know what mass is. There's a bit of information we call charge. We don't know what that is. There's a bit of information we call spin, which isn't spin at all, but that's what we call it. We don't know what it is. And we know how those bits of information interact with each other and how that builds up into atoms and various other things. But we don't know what's there. And yet what's happening, all this information is being integrated into this. So this experience right now is how that information appears in consciousness. This is how information appears in consciousness, is all this colour, sensation, sound, feelings, all of that. And of course, all our thoughts that are going on at the same time. The thoughts you're having about this, the conversations that are going on in your mind, they're also just another appearance in consciousness. And there's an analogy that's often used of the waves on an ocean. It's like the consciousness itself is like the water. And then what arises on the water is the disturbance of energy creates waves. And so there's activity in the water caused by whatever it is, there's some disturbance, currents or winds or whatever, cause waves to appear. And then we see the waves and they become forms, which we then, you know, see moving around and interacting and doing things. It's similar with consciousness. There is just consciousness, which is then stirred by what's coming in through the senses, through the body, through other things. Basically, it's stirred by what's going on in the brain. The brain is stirring consciousness into all these forms, far more complex than the waves on an ocean. But that's what it is. It's a multidimensional activity of consciousness, which we are continually engrossed in, really. Awareness. Ultimately, it's awareness is aware of awareness. Awareness is aware of awareness in action. And then we get caught up in it. And for good reason. I mean, from a biological perspective, this is all very, very useful. It's a very useful virtual reality that helps us navigate the world. The abstract information would be useless. We need the information to take this form to actually navigate through the world. And this is really what I think is the essence of non-duality. Well, the original meaning of non-duality. Again, people talk about non-duality, you know, as, oh, non-duality means we're all one. It doesn't really mean that, not in the sense of an outward sense. There is a sense of being one, but it's a much deeper sense. Or that, you know, it's not, things aren't black and white, you know, we have to get rid of male, female. That, you know, that may be valuable, but that's not what really non-duality is about. Non-duality comes from the, it's a direct translation of the Sanskrit word Advaita, which means not dual. That's the literal translation, not dual, not two. But it doesn't say one. If they meant one, they'd have used the Sanskrit word for oneness. What it means is it's not just two. And one of the earliest teachings on non-duality that I know of goes back to the Chandogya Upanishad, where one of the teachers, well, a teacher is talking to his son, and his son has gone off to school, and his son's been at school for 10 years and studying all the Vedic scriptures and all they studied in those days, the astrology and the rituals and whatever it was they studied. He comes home from 10 years of study and very proud of himself and telling his father all the stuff he learned. And his father says, yes, yes, my son, yes, my son, yes. But did they teach you about that by which all this is known? And he said, what? No, they didn't. What do you mean? What is that by which all this is known? And then the father goes into this long dialogue, and that's the Upanishad, this whole teaching, which he brings up different examples of that. And in that is the story of, well, he says, you see these two pots made of clay. They're both made of clay. They are different. They are very different. This pot is not that pot. Mm-hmm. There is distinction. This pot is very different from that pot. There is duality. It's not an illusion. Duality is real, or difference is real. And they're both made of clay. Their essence is the same. The essence is the same. They're both made of clay. And then pointing out that the clay does not lose its clayness by becoming a pot. Mm-hmm. The clay remains clay. It remains totally unchanged. Just the form is different. And what we see are the forms. And that, to me, is what the essence of non-duality is, that the awareness in itself is unchanged. The awareness itself doesn't change, but how it appears changes. How it's moved by the brain, if you like, the forms it takes is continually changing. But awareness itself doesn't change. It's untouched by what is going on. Just as, you know, the water stays water. Whatever the wave, the water still stays water. So that is really, to me, the root of Advaita, I think one of the best understandings of Advaita. And then he goes on into lots of other stories. But essential to our experience of consciousness is the whole question of self, the nature of self, and the experience of self. We say, I am aware. I am aware of this. I am thinking this. That I is like the central point of experience. That sense of I, the I that is aware, that, I would suggest, doesn't change. How it feels to be me as I is how it's felt all my life. What's changed is my values, my personality, my ambitions, my... All that stuff has changed, but that deep, deep sense of I-ness, that sense of I am aware, doesn't change. When we say I in that sense, I think what we're talking about is how it feels to be aware. How it actually feels to be aware is a very deeply intimate, personal thing, which we call I. But when we actually look deeply at it, you don't find any I. It's a term we use, and as, you know, many philosophers have pointed out, when you look deeply, you don't find I. You know, when I look for the self, all I find is I find feelings, I find perceptions, I find this and that. I don't find I.
Nothing.
There's nothing.
Terrifying and wonderful.
Yeah. It's terrifying if you think there should be an I. But there's two senses of I here that we talk about. This sense that the I that is aware, I am aware. When you look deeply into that, and that is what the mystical path is, looking into what is that nature of the I that is aware, the awareness or the realization that comes is there, it's just the name we give to being aware. And I like to talk about it as a verb. There is aming. It's not that I am. The I drops out. There is just aming. It's just being. Being in the first person. I mean, the verb to be, I am, you are, it is. Being in the third person is isness. There's are-ing. And there's aming. There's aming. There's aming. It's that quality of how it feels to be aware. It's very, very personal. It's so deeply intimate and familiar and personal. And we give it a name, we give it a noun, I, we make it a noun. And in doing that, we make it a thing. And then we start looking for a thing, which is I, and you have I looking for something to be aware of, which is I, and you come up with all these different things. Or maybe I am this, maybe I am that, or maybe I am this feeling in the heart. Maybe, these are all experiences that I am aware of. And it's probably a truism. If you ever think you have found the I in that sense, you'd be pretty sure you haven't, because all you found is another object of experience. Maybe fascinating, maybe illuminating, maybe, you know, deep spiritual insight. But it's not the I that is aware doesn't actually exist. It's just, another way to put it, it's just awareing. Coming back to where we started, even the words consciousness and awareness, I think, are wrong. Because they're nouns.
Mm-hmm.
When you put N-E-S-S onto a word, you basically take an adjective and you create an abstract noun in order to converse about it. You know, like, you know, happiness. There is the experience of being happy, that we know. Happiness doesn't actually exist as a thing. The experience of being happy exists. We know that, or whatever else we want to call it, or sadness, or redness, whatever. The experience of seeing red exists, but redness is a thing. It's just an abstract way of talking about it. And it's the same with consciousness and awareness. There is the being aware, which we all know, I am aware. So being aware is the true thing. And then we add NESS and talk about consciousness and awareness as a way of conversing about it, a very useful way of conversing about it. But then we fall into the trap of thinking that there's something called consciousness,
right,
and something called awareness. It's just a way of thinking. What we're referring to is the fact of being aware, of being conscious, of having it, being able to experience things. So that's one sense of the I. That's the more mystical sense of the I, is what we call being aware, that quality of being aware. And it's really, you know, awareness of something, and then we add the I, and we create this sort of, we create a dualism in our mind. I am aware of this. And the truth is, really, there is awareness of this. Instead of saying, you know, I am aware of the carpet, there is awareness of the carpet.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other sense of I that creeps in is in our thinking. It's this sense of being a personal, individual, unique, separate self, which is often loosely called the ego or the ego mind. Again, it doesn't exist. If you look for it, you can't find it. It's a thought system. It's a way of thinking about the world, a mindset about how we interact with the world, which is based upon the body. It's like, here is this organism, and part of our job in the world is to keep this organism safe, to help it survive, to navigate the world. And so in our thinking, we form a model of self based on the organism. It's a body-oriented sense of self, which is there to help us navigate this body through the world. But it's also how to navigate it through society and through our relationships and emotions and all that stuff. But it's a sense, it's an individual sense of self. I like to call it the personal self. It's a personal sense of self which changes. It changes a lot. What this self is changes over time. It can change from 1 hour to the next, depending on the underlying emotions, mindsets which are guiding it. It can feel very different. But it's a framework of thinking that's there essentially to help us survive. This is the individual self, the personal self. And that's the self that most people know 99.99% of the time. That's the self that we live our lives by. It's the self that is there in all our thinking. Nearly every thought you have, there's a sense of that personal, individual self there in some way or another. If you look at most of your thoughts, not all of them, but a lot of them about, in one way or another, what I would like to see happen in the world in order that I can be safe and can be happy and can enjoy life, etc., etc. How I would like other people to be, or how I would have liked them to be yesterday if they weren't so just stupid, whatever it was. So that's that individual personal sense of self, which is, again, many teachings point out, is ultimately based on fear. It's based upon the idea that things in the world aren't right and that I need to sort things out, correct the world, or keep the world the same in order that I can be happy, because if I'm happy, it means I'm doing okay, I'm surviving, I'm safe. And that's the that sense of personal self is the self that, say, most people live by, and they think that's who they are. And that self appears as a voice in your head, which is chatting to you, telling you what's going on, whether you agree with this or disagree with it, and how nice things are, how bad things are, what you should do, what they should do, and what the president should do, and whatever it is. And it chats away. It's a conversation. Mm-hmm. And that voice is so familiar that we think it is us. We think it's me. It's not. It's just a voice that's appearing in the mind. I am that which is aware of the voice. We lose that distinction. I am here. aware of the conversation that's going on. But because we get locked up in the conversation, we identify with the conversation, we totally forget the I, the being aware, which is that unchanging foundation to experience, which is always there. That's what so many spiritual teachings are about, in one way or another, is how to step out of that egocentric voice, how to leave that behind and come back to the pure beingness, how to come back to that. So, I mean, another aspect of non-dualism, which ties in with this, is the notion that there's nowhere to get to. We're not trying to get somewhere else. This comes up in a lot of non-dual teachings.
Yeah.
There's nowhere to get to. It's actually the trying to get somewhere is the problem.
Do you mean like improve?
Improve or get to a certain state of consciousness, having another experience, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. It's about, and the wanting to get to somewhere is, again, it's our thinking mind that thinks, if I just got somewhere, I would be wonderful, I would be free, I would be liberated, whatever it is. It's more, it's the letting go of there being anywhere to get to, and the letting go of the thinking that have how things ought to be, and really stepping back from the thinking, letting go of the thinking, so you just come back to the present. I was thinking earlier today about something, I think there's a lovely line from the Course in Miracles: a journey without distance to a place you never left. So in that sense, it's not about trying to get somewhere else. It's about how do we return home? How do we return back to our own beingness? And for me, the essence of that is simply choosing not to follow the thought is the essence of it. What we do is, we get interested in a thought, and we think the thoughts are important.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are, but others aren't important at all. They're things we've thought before, or whatever, complete waste of time. They're things we imagine might happen, but probably never do or never could do, but they're interesting. We get caught up, the ego mind gets caught up in the thinking because it's interesting. And we just follow one thought through another, to another, to another, and we go to sleep and we wake up and we start off with another thought and we just follow it through the day. And our attention is just following this train of this inner dialogue that's going on. I see meditation as a way of actually interrupting that. And when you do, you come back to noticing the present moment. You notice what is. In a way, this, that we live in two realities. There's this reality, which I call the primary reality, which is what I'm seeing, hearing, feeling, tasting, what's going on inside my body, you know, sensations in my body. This is the primary organic reality. And then our thoughts take us into a secondary imagined reality. When we start thinking something, a little imagination, I call it a thought bubble, starts off in the mind. We start thinking something, we get interested in it, it gets more serious. And before we know what, we're in this full-blown imagined dream we created about something or other. And we're hardly conscious of this reality. Our attention is so caught up in this imagined reality, the second reality, we lose touch with the present moment. And those imagined realities are always about the past or the future in some way. We get drawn into this imagined reality. And it's a dream. It's a waking dream that we get sucked into. And that's what I think, you know, a lot of teachers are talking about when they say we need to wake up from the dream. This is real. The dream is where we go in our head. The imagined reality we get taken off in our head. That's the dream that we need to wake up from. To wake up from that dream and come back to here, this, now, this reality, the present moment. And that's when you reconnect with the beingness. There's a line I love from the opening of the Yoga Sutras. Some of you may know the Yoga Sutras. It's by Patanjali, written about 800 or so AD. Which to me, they contain the essence of it. You go back hundreds of years, things weren't written down so much. They were handed down orally, through oral traditions. And in order to keep the oral tradition, you condense teachings into sutras. A sutra means a thread. So you condense the teaching into a very concise thread of 3, 4, 5 words, or whatever it was in Sanskrit. And the job of the teacher was then to unpack those words and display the deeper meaning of those words. But you could get students to remember the sutras and hand the sutras down. It was a way of handing the teachings down. And the first sutra is Yogas Chitta Vritti Nirodha. 4 words. Yoga. Again, how you interpret those, Sanskrit is so open to different interpretations. Yoga, I mean, most people know, comes from the word, the same word as join, to unite, union. I think it's often misunderstood as becoming united with something, which is actually a very dualistic concept. It's like, I here am going to become united with God, with the essence of the universe, with whatever it is that I am going to become united with something. Whereas a dualistic way of thinking about it, my way of thinking about it, the oneness is the end of the separation. It's the dissolving of separation. Rather than uniting with something else, I see it as a dissolving of the separation. And it's the ego self which is living in the world of separation. Me here, me, this body, the rest of the world. That's the fundamental separation. Mm-hmm. What the other 3 words mean is the whirling of mind stuff. The whirling of mind stuff is the whirling of thinking experience that we get caught up in. And Nirodha has several meanings, but the one that's usually translated is ceasing. So the way I take the first line is when the whirling of mind stuff, you know, we're getting caught up in all this thinking and stuff, when the whirling of mind stuff comes to an end, then the separation comes to an end, the sense of separation comes to an end. And the second line is, then there is abiding in the true nature of the knower, the I, the being aware. When the whirling of the mind stuff stops, then you begin to recognize the true nature of the knower. And then the third line says, otherwise, there is identification with the whirling of mind stuff. Otherwise, you identify with all the thoughts and stories which are going on. That becomes the reality you live in. The waking, the secondary reality, the waking dream. You identify with the waking dream. I mean, just to mention there, because I haven't touched on it, love is, again, a common theme in so many traditions. You know, God is love, that love is the essence, I am love. I think, again, we sometimes misconceive that as I have got to find a way to love everybody, which is great. I mean, nothing wrong with that. The actual nature of being is loving. Its actual nature of being is it's a loving nature. And when you drop back into that beingness, you find there is a lovingness to it. So love isn't something you have to find. It's something you have to remove the barriers to. Swami Muktananda said, love is the secret sensation of the self. It's secret. I translate secret as meaning it's something we don't know. It's something that's hidden from us. Love is the secret sensation. It's how the self actually feels. The self feels loving. It's how it feels. But it's secret because we are so caught up in all the other stuff. We don't recognize it. We don't know that lovingness. And so the way to, again, the way to open the heart is to step out of that which closes it. In a sense, the heart is already open. The heart is already open. It's the mind that gets closed, the thinking mind, the ego mind which gets closed and takes the attention away from the heart. And the openness of the heart. And that to me is, you know, one of the more profound benefits, reasons for the spiritual work is, apart from freeing ourselves from, you know, so much of the distraction of the ego mind, apart from all that, is to fall back into the heart space, the lovingness. That is clearly what is needed in the world today, is becoming from an open-hearted space than a right-minded space. When we drop back into just being pure awareness, we experience lovingness. So we also experience, I would say, deep peace as well, deep ease, those sort of qualities, joy. They are qualities of experience that appear when we step out of the ego mind and come back to beingness. So that they're connected, but they're not the same. Awareness isn't anything. It isn't anything. And as soon as you say awareness is anything, I think we made a mistake. And we know exactly what it means to be aware. Yeah. We don't need to define it. We know exactly what it means to be aware. That's the mistake, that you define awareness or say awareness is anything, is an intrinsic mistake. It's like, all we need to do is to say, you know, am I aware? And the answer is yes.